So we're here at the Folger Theater rehearsing and doing tech rehearsals for our upcoming world premiere of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged. And we feel strangely under a microscope, not just because we're about to be reviewed by the Washington Theater Press, but also we are literally being studied by a doctor, or a soon-to-be doctor, with the Dickensian name of Ronan Hatful. Dr. Hatful, why are you looking at me like this?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at you like that because that's the first time anybody's ever called me Dr. Hatful.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 488, Studying Reduced Shakespeare. Doctoral candidate Ronan Hatful is visiting Washington, D.C. from the University of Warwick in Coventry, England. He's here to research 21st century interpretations of Shakespeare, and he's focusing on the work of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. He's been sitting in on rehearsals of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, and asking questions about our process, and it's been fun being asked to think about and articulate just what the hell it is we do. So I asked Ronan to let me ask him about his dissertation, and he was gracious enough to talk to me about it.
I am at the University of Warwick on the English Literature, English Literature and Comparative Literary Studies, as they like to call it, program, doing a PhD over in England. It started as a project where I was looking at Shakespeare's influence on an American novelist called Cormac McCarthy. By the end of my first year, I was tearing my hair out, and McCarthy, from what you may know of his work, is not the most cheery man in the whole world. The project was fine, but it was sort of just ebbing and flowing. And I got to the end of my first year, and I changed tack, and I realised that what I really wanted to look at was Shakespearean performance in America and how American companies and individuals and entrepreneurs like yourselves. Take Shakespeare in a particular way and how that works in America, both in its own right and in comparison to Brits and Europeans. I started more looking at the title of my thesis is Popularization in 21st Century Shakespop, which is a word that I've taken from an esteemed academic called Douglas Lanier.
So this is a term of art, Shakespop.
Shakespop, yeah. There's a lot of kind of those terms being bandied about. Mm-hmm. But Shakespop was the one that I liked because it's an amalgamation of two of my favourite things.
A portmanteau, as it were.
Oh, as it were, a portmanteau.
In the way that Shakespeare himself invented so many words, Shakespop is a Shakespearean word in its origin.
Well, to briefly deviate, which I often do, my whole life is a series of deviations, I like to think.
Right.
I've been accused of making up a word by multiple colleagues and supervisors, which is palimpsestuous.
Oh, that's a word.
Yes, palimpsestuous. A palimpsest is something. It originally meant a manuscript that existed, and then somebody would cover it with a new text, a new piece of work, and gradually it's taken on this meaning within adaptations theory and studies, which is kind of the field I'm working within. To mean adaptation. Okay. And in some ways, that's what I see you guys doing, because you're taking Shakespeare as your baseline, if you know what I mean, and you're building on top of him. And particularly with this new work, which I'm sure we'll get onto, you're building more and more and more and more layers.
Right. It's interesting you say that, because we just did an interview with somebody who said, she's intimidated by Shakespeare, and Shakespeare is kind of serious, and then she wandered into this divergence of where she talks about, I get emails from people who use these made-up words, and I just want to smack her. And I'm going, you are so not being Shakespearean in spirit.
Yeah.
You know, Shakespeare himself made up words, and he was not precious about the language. That's what's so fun about him, is that he contributed so much to the language we use today.
Yeah. Well, it's obviously...
I guess Shakespeare was palimpsestuous as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, and I will not be, I'm not the first person to say this, and I won't be the last, but Shakespeare clearly adapted himself. I told, you know, you make jokes about this, but Shakespeare stole everything, virtually. I think the only original plot Shakespeare wrote, I mean, don't quote me on this, but I think it's The Tempest. I think that's right.
Okay.
I mean, you might want to fact.
I'll take it from you. Yeah, no.
But yeah, Shakespeare's, you know, Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet. They're all archetypal plots in many ways. Right. You know, and it's not just Shakespeare. Look at Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe. Mm-hmm. All of these people were adapting and twisting and bleeding new ideas. And I mean, you make the joke in your new text about Shakespeare and Disney's relationship, and I mean, but lots of what Disney, you know, lots of the things that Disney adapt are tales as old as time.
Yes, exactly.
Segue.
Well quoted.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, and it's certainly what we've done. Yeah. I mean, we've taken Shakespearean texts and made free of them.
Exactly.
You know,
one of my favorite things in it, you know, to give a little snippet. Well, I can't quote from it verbatim, but one of my favorite moments in Long Lost Shakes is your monologue at the end when you talk about these, you know, Shakespeare had... It could smack of bardolatry if you looked at it a particular way, but because of the way that you operate as a theatre company, it clearly doesn't come across like that. And it's this moment when you talk about these characters will outlive all of the audience members, which is kind of poignant and beautiful, but also the fact that Shakespeare writes the life around us and these other plays, you know, The Lion King, all these things. That, it's not to say that they are Shakespeare's,
right,
but they wouldn't exist without Shakespeare.
Well, indeed.
So I love the idea that Shakespeare, and I love the idea, the kind of facetious way that you're looking at the fact that Shakespeare saw that what he was doing would have some sense of legacy. I don't know whether he did or not. I think the beautiful thing about Shakespeare, I think, is he seems like a man. I'm purely speculating, but a man who was writing very much in the moment.
Yes.
And a man writing for purpose as well. Not, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why, compared to Johnson or Marlowe or whoever else, he was so prolific.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he didn't set out to publish any of his own stuff. It wasn't a thing that was done at that time. He was, you know, he wanted to put the butts in the seats. You know, he made his money from the number of tickets that he sold, not from his royalties as a playwright, because neither royalties nor the word playwright existed at that time. So is the thrust of your gist, if that's a phrase, is the thrust of your dissertation that we're on a continuum, all of us are on a continuum where that maybe begun with Shakespeare, or no, it didn't begin, he was part of the continuum as and so that, and these 21st century entrepreneurs are continuing this legacy or furthering it?
That is a good way of putting it. I think one of the things that, because I initially started the project by being interested in these individuals, so I'll quickly say what they are. So they're you guys, the RSC, a rapper who works pedagogically with kids, but also is an artist in his own right, called Devon Glover, who goes by the stage name of The Sonnet Man.
Cool.
Who's amazing. And then that's the performance half of my thesis. And the second half is looking more at visual media. So I'm looking at a film adaptation of Cymbeline, which was directed by Michael Almereyda, starring Ethan Hawke last year, which is awful. But intriguing.
That's interesting that you're spending time on a film that doesn't work.
Yeah.
But yet there's some value in it, clearly.
Well, I mean, the final example is House of Cards, which is obviously not a straight Shakespearean adaptation.
No, but clearly influenced.
Yeah, and clearly, and also it's based on a British series, which is a lot more explicitly Shakespearean, which is itself based on a British novel, which is even more explicitly Shakespearean. So there's these kind of tangential layers of meaning, and it's this thing of being, how removed from Shakespeare are you? And I'm really fascinated by that. So I've actually
Go back. You're fascinated by how removed you are from Shakespeare, or how present. And or how present Shakespeare is in these modern interpretations?
Yeah, I am. I am. I'm really interested in how far away something can be from Shakespeare and yet still resonate as being Shakespearean.
Interesting.
So that's the way I've structured my thesis. And this is up for debate, but actually my first chapter is on you guys, my second is on The Sonnet Man, my third is on Cymbeline, and my fourth is on House of Cards. I won't go into all the detail of that, but in my opinion, as they move gradually, they, and it's not to do with being faithful or paying fidelity towards Shakespeare, because that, if that was the continuum of my work, then that would suggest that you are the company or the individual, the collective, out of all of those that pay the most fidelity towards Shakespeare. When actually, I don't think that's true at all. I think you're very irreverent. You have a totally irreverent attitude towards Shakespeare, even though you do, you know, you clearly love the work, but you have this irreverent, playful nature. Whereas I'd say actually something like House of Cards, in the way it sometimes either directly quotes Shakespeare or just appropriates his plots, actually there is a kind of reverence there. And you know, you just interview Kevin Spacey and you get that from him. He's much more like that than you guys. But what I mean is that the order of the continuum that I'm working on is this idea that that lots of American art is appropriating Shakespeare in different ways, and basically the order I'm looking at is I've theorised it that you can get gradually further and further away from Shakespeare, but it still has this entrepreneurial spirit. I was looking at Thomas Jefferson's statue and thinking, and actually made me think quite a lot about this pioneering spirit towards, you know, American pioneering spirit towards everything. But actually, I think that obviously holds true with Shakespeare, particularly. And there's a lot of a sense with you guys, you know, even before you and Reed were involved, that the original guys, and I hope they won't mind me saying this, but it's almost the way they fell into this being such a sensation was it was almost like a hobby that got out of hand. A hobby that they loved and doing it was successful, but then, you know, I know that from what I've read, and I've talked to Daniel Singer a bit online, saying that they came over to the UK to the Edinburgh Festival thinking that was the culmination of what they were going to do, and it was just this, it was, you know, it was
just the beginning.
It was just the beginning, exactly. So I think, and
but I think that's true about so many things, so many successful artistic endeavors, is that they were done originally for the love of it, and then you found a way, oh my gosh, this could actually be something. Maybe you'll get paid for it down the line.
I think there's amongst American adaptations of Shakespeare like yourselves and the Sonnet Man, there's this sense, compared to quite a lot of British adaptations, so this is not to denigrate British adaptations of Shakespeare, but there's a pragmatism towards it. There's this kind of fitting around the text and you know, adaptation that is adaptable, that can fit into different kind of bodies and can be quite fluid. Whereas there's a lot of British adaptations. So I would compare you guys in some ways to something like the National Theatre of Brent as being a British equivalent.
The National Theatre of Brent, for those that don't know, are two guys, Patrick Barlow and Jim Broadbent, who I'm sure many of you know. Patrick Barlow is also well known in his circle. He directed and adapted 39 Steps, for example. And Jim Broadbent, everybody knows. But anyway, National Theatre of Brent.
Yeah, and I would say that, and the other continuum is that, the other comparison is Devon Glover has a very clear equivalent in a British rapper called Akala, who's set up a thing called the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, which is amazing and is doing brilliant things. But the difference for me is that lots of these two British adaptations, there's a fixedness. They have a set of rules that they abide by. And it's almost like they've had a game plan from the very start of what they're doing. And that doesn't make them bad or worse or unworthy. Right. But one of the things that fascinates me about American adaptations in particular is this flexibility.
Right.
And also this idea of... I was talking to my supervisor about you guys and about Devon, and he described you... Paul Prescott, name drop. he described you guys... Thank you, Paul. He described you guys as being these kind of... These boys that have done good. Yeah. And there's this kind of... Not falling into it, but this approach towards Shakespeare that's very organic.
Right.
And very popular. And populist. Very
populist, yes. Yeah.
I'm Peter Holland. I'm the McNeil Family Professor in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and you're listening to the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This week we open in the world reduced Shakespeare Company premiere of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Folger Theater at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. We'll be here until May 8th. Then we hit the road again, taking the complete history of comedy Abridged to Saratoga, Rancho Cucamonga, and Poway, California, Gillette, Wyoming, Reston, Virginia, and Somerville, New Jersey. And very, very soon, hopefully next week, we can tell you about something very exciting that will be happening this summer. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. You were talking about, you know, things being organic or things being their own thing. I remember we talked about this in our book, Reduced Shakespeare, The Complete Guide for the Attention Impaired Abridged. This looking at John Turturro's film adaptation of Macbeth that he called Joe Macbeth?
I've never seen it, but I know the thing you mean.
Yeah,
a bit of it.
I think it was called Joe Macbeth. Anyway, it was Macbeth set in a gangster world.
Yeah.
Set in the world of gangsters.
Yeah.
But it was such a literal translation into this, it was kind of like kind of lay there inert. It was never became its own thing. Whereas the Sopranos seems authentically, genuinely Shakespearean, and there's not a drop probably of actual Shakespeare, but it feels epic and deep and rich and organic and true, and less more of just an adaptation set in a world like a bad directorial conception.
Yeah.
Although I will say the Turturro film version did have one great line that I loved, which is when Joe Macbeth says, "Not a man or woman born can do shit to me." So I like that line. But other than that, but it sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit.
Yeah, no, definitely. That actually applies quite heavily to two of my case studies, which is Cymbeline and House of Cards.
Right.
And I watching the Cymbeline adaptation is also set in a gangster world. It's a biker Shakespeare,
right.
And it was only called Cymbeline, I think, when they released it online. It was actually, and you'll see the analogy, they released it in cinemas, I think very limited release, and they called it Anarchy.
Oh, after Sons of Anarchy.
Initially, it was when I first saw the trailer and quite excited by it. It was going to be called Cymbeline, and then they changed the title to Anarchy, clearly trying to corner that market. And actually, I tell a lie, when they released it online on Amazon DVD, they renamed it again and they called it Anarchy: Ride or Die, which is the worst title of the three.
Yeah, right, right.
So,
they clearly don't know. I mean, this is a camel is a horse horse designed by a committee.
Exactly.
You know, that's
feels
like.
Precisely. But for me, with that film, it would have been a much more effective adaptation of something that it's an interesting idea to take a play that very few people who don't know that Shakespeare know at all. It would have been far more effective. I will confess to never having seen Sons of Anarchy.
Okay.
But I know from the people that talk to me about it, and I know people have written papers about this, that it's heavily alludes to Hamlet,
right?
Exactly the thing that you're saying, I think, pertains to that. If you watch Sons of Anarchy, bizarrely, it's probably more Shakespearean than this film called Anarchy, which is Cymbeline.
This is the thing that one hopefully learns from Shakespeare, is that Shakespeare took existing texts and even existing history and said, screw it, I'm going to take what I need and change what I want.
Mm.
And it feels like the original pieces of art are the contemporary original pieces of art are the ones that do the same thing.
Yeah.
Not be quite so literal to your source, but take and pick and choose.
I think that's why, for me, and it's a classic example, but that's why, for me, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, which I know it has its detractors, but still works for me above all of those. Because even though that obviously does use Shakespeare's text verbatim, it did pick and choose. It didn't feel the need to be overtly faithful to the source text, and as a result,
nor to its received how it's supposed to be produced.
Yeah, its received audience.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
I mean, obviously, it was Shakespeare for the MTV generation, but I don't feel that Baz Luhrmann making that film was deliberately trying to do that. He was probably had it aware in the periphery.
Yeah.
Compared to, and I've not watched all of it yet, but compared to the Michael Amory Hamlet, which was released at a similar time, which clearly is is, which, you know, has these self-reflective bits of Ethan Hawke, you know, doing to be or not to be, that is the question, walking in a blockbuster.
Right, right.
And it's just, and it's so, so cringeworthy.
Yeah.
Whereas all the product placement moments in Romeo and Juliet feel like they work because...
They feel organic, yeah.
Exactly, organic, yeah. And I think, obviously, both those examples we're talking about are American, but I would compare it to Michael Fassbender's Macbeth.
Okay.
Last year, which to me was a great film, but it just felt like a heritage piece. Yeah. And again, I would compare that again, weirdly, another funny comparison. It felt like it was a good film.
Yeah.
It was a good film. Don't get me wrong, but it felt like it was the audience it was targeting was probably the Game of Thrones audience.
Interesting. Yeah.
And again, Game of Thrones is its own thing, and much more Shakespearean than a lot of these actual kind of these real Shakespeare.
Well, and it's inspired by the Henriette plays at least, or influenced, I guess, maybe not inspired.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And that's obviously, for me, that obviously inspired the way that they released The Hollow Crown as a box set, as a series of... So, I think that...
I remember when you first reached out to us, you were interested in writing about the Reduced Shakespeare Company. It was like, oh, great, I can put you in touch with Daniel and Jess and Adam, the original guys, and talk about the complete works all you want. But then when I told you that we were writing this new play, you went... I'm coming to D.C., you know? That was really cool. So, I mean, your dissertation comes along right at the time that the Reduced Shakespeare Company has returned to its Shakespearean roots.
Yeah.
You know, both so our first show and our 10th show. And you're here, and not only are you looking at our rehearsals, wandering into our rehearsals, but you're tapping into the resources of the Folger Shakespeare Library. What's that like?
Well, the Folger Shakespeare Library is amazing, and it's been a real eye-opener for me in terms of scholarship and where I want to go. So it's definitely increased the amount that I actually want to do this as a career. And also it's a kind of breathtaking place. I think in fact, the first day I was quite overawed. I won't lie. I'm not really working with hardcore archival material, so I'm not, you know, they wouldn't let me dig out the first folio. But I'm
So your point is you could go to any library that has a pretty good selection of scholarly works on Shakespeare.
Yeah, I've not come here. I mean, for me, the reason I've come here, the resource is you guys.
Yeah, right.
Is physical human beings.
What is it called? The primary source.
Yeah. You are the primary source. You are my folio.
Wow, that was very Jedi of you.
I don't know why I delivered it like Qui-Gon Jinn, but there you go. So in terms of where my kind of interest shifted and why I latched onto that so quickly and said I'm coming to DC, I think for me it felt because the Reduced Shakespeare Company for me have been criminally ignored. By the academic community, there is stuff. There's very good stuff written on them by people I know. Steve Purcell, who's taught me, who's written a very good piece on you. But most of these articles are only not even articles. Most of these sections in books, very good sections, but there'll be 3 or 4 pages of very detailed analysis of the complete works. But they're just part of a bigger thing that's analysing adaptation or Shakespeare on stage or parody.
Right.
And for me, it felt. I wanted to do a chapter on complete works anyway because that felt like something quite new to do, and it felt like it was worthy of extended study. Clearly, but then when I learned that you were doing this, it just felt to me that was actually that was even more interesting because and obviously my initial assumptions were that this was a show, and I know. You could argue that it's been marketed in that way by other people, maybe not by yourselves, but as being a return to your roots. Mm-hmm. But then when I talked to you even more, the fact that actually you kept saying to me that it really isn't a return to your roots in terms of it's a departure stylistically and in terms of the way you researched to write the show, and also the fact that it might lead you to go in a completely different direction next.
Yeah.
That for me was the gold. That was the pot at the end of the rainbow. That was the thing that really fired my imagination.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. send us your dissertation via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Doctor of Laughology Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Lydia Bratton. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Peter Holland, the McNeil Family Professor of Shakespeare at Notre Dame University. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 488 1464ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. In a city like Washington, D.C., full of ancient monuments, would you find Reed and I to be fitting in quite nicely?
Yeah. I don't feel I can answer that politely.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.